Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. My esteemed guest today is none other than the one-time queen of extreme, the inimitable Kim Reichel. Kim and I are going to reminisce about our time together at the Snow Country Magazine ski test in the early 90s, but oddly enough, that wasn't the high point of her career. She is best known as the creator of perhaps the first and still the longest-running women's ski camps, which came after a career in ski racing that landed her on the U.S. ski team. She is notorious for a fairly spectacular crash that occurred while filming with Greg Stump and Bruce Benedict on License to Thrill, a spill that went viral before viral was a thing. A big mountain competition champion as well as a world-class windsurfer, we caught up with Kim yesterday. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Jackson. It's lovely to be on. Thank you for asking me.
Kim, let's peel back the veil of time to your youth, growing up in New England. What was your mother mountain that nurtured you? Was it Stratton? And how did you get involved in racing?
My family chose Stratton when I was three. My older brother, Scott, was five. And Todd, my younger brother, had just been born. And my dad's like, we're going to be a skiing family. And just decided that we were going to get up to Vermont. And we went to a couple different Southern Vermont resorts. But within, I think, 3 or 4 weeks, they chose Stratton because they liked the way the management treated the family, and they felt that we as young kids were safe. And so it was 1963, Stratton Mountain became our home.
And they had a race program there. In fact, I think they had a secondary school associated with Stratton. Didn't they have a sort of a racing incubation program? Yes. There at Stratton?
It's called a ski academy, Jackson.
Yes. Thank you, Kim.
I have to say, fortunately for me, I was a part of the Stratton Mountain School in its infancy. My family donated our Stratton home to be a dorm for a lot of the skiers. The women stayed. So I was 12 years old when I started attending Ski Academy and the winter tutorial program, and extremely lucky. You know, I look back and I mean, I think I've been skiing 100 days a year since I was 12 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of skiing, right?
So you grew up through that program, and that exposed you to competition eventually at the highest level for your age group?
Definitely. You know, the story is that I was always an athlete. I've been an athlete. That's where I hang my hat. I did not get A's and B's. The first A I ever got in school was in gym. So it might have been the only A I ever got in school. I struggled in school. I was very dyslexic at a time that dyslexia wasn't really addressed. And I actually got called retarded. Sorry for the wrong term, but at that time. But all my confidence came from my athleticism. I won at Foursquare and I owned the jungle gym and I was the first to be picked for the kickball team. I was an athlete from a very young age. And I can remember being at Stratton as a young skier and seeing the ski racers and going, those guys, those are the best skiers on the mountain.
At that time, racers were unequivocally regarded as the pinnacle of the athletic achievement in the sport. We didn't have all these other diversions that have since occupied the same stage.
Exactly. And I picked out the racers from a mile away and I said, I want to be one of them. Those are not only are they the best skiers on the mountain, but they're the coolest people.
Right. They really were. There wasn't the gulf that currently separates the race community from the recreational community. They were more integrated. There was more of a progression from one to the other. For instance, yeah. All the top skiers didn't ski on a fat ski or a shape ski or whatever. They skied on a race ski.
Yeah.
Everybody did. What was your progression as a racer? Were you specialized first in one event and then gradually moved to all events?
I was a slalom NGS skier. Back in those days, Super G didn't exist. And obviously being in Vermont, downhill wasn't something that I was able to nurture as a young ski racer. And really slalom was my specialty. I was very quick. I was just a fast, quick down the hill as fast as I could go. And I also had and continue to have, as you know, throughout my career, the ability to just let it go. Just step in that starting gate and go over 100% top to bottom and not care if I fell. I'm either going to win and be on the podium or I'm going to fall. And for me,
which prevailed at first? Did you have your share of wipeouts?
Oh, yeah. And when it became an issue when I went to college, because I was very selfish, because I didn't really care about anybody else but myself. I wanted to win. And if I wasn't going to win, I was going to fall. And that was it. I was willing to put it on the line. And that works all fine and dandy as an amateur ski racer. But once you go to college, it's a team sport. And you can't be selfish. You have to learn to care about other people and contribute to the team effort. And as one of the better skiers on the team at the University of Colorado, I wasn't dependable in the beginning because a lot of the times I'd fall. And that just doesn't help a team at all. It was a great learning experience for me and really helped me parlay my career into what I later on did in the ski industry, learning how to give up something of my own, to give up a little bit of myself for others, and then learning how incredibly rewarding that is. And so much greater than the individual win is the team win. And I feel very fortunate that I got to experience that.
When did you make the transition to the US ski team? Did they tap you when you were at CU?
No. And you know, it's really too bad because I was a slow bloomer, a late mature, as I should say. And back then, they really wanted them young. Most of the best ski racers in Women World Cup were teenagers. And the US ski team sort of felt like if you weren't racing and scoring World Cup points by the time you were 16, 17 years old, you weren't going to make it. And that's kind of what happened to me. I was just getting my feet wet and figuring things out with a ski team. They picked me up when I was 15 and I raced Europa Cup. I never got to race in a World Cup. Still to this day, I feel that I hadn't come anywhere near my peak as an athlete, both physically and psychologically. My mental stamina got much better as I got older. I just got more mature about all of it. The travel and there's just so much more to ski racing than just stepping in the starting gate and going.
Historically, college or elite racing weren't compatible. You did one or the other.
Yes, absolutely. Certainly when I was ski racing, it's a lot more available now. The ski team is much more open to athletes that do go to college and compete well in college and mature as ski racers and are given opportunities to race World Cup after college or mid-college career. And sometimes it can be healthy for the young athlete to have a little bit of a distraction and have something else going on so that it's not just absolutely everything on the line to make the US ski team and get into the Olympics.
Did you go straight from racing to so-called extreme contests? I'm sure that now I guess we'd say big mountain type contest, but then I think extreme was even
back then it was called extreme. Yeah. Gina Croft cloned me as the queen of extreme. Yeah, I was so embarrassed when she did that.
You wear the crown well. When and where did you compete in what had to have been the first extreme competitions?
So the first ever World Extreme Skiing Championships was in Valdez, Alaska. And I ski raced amateur, then I ski raced for the University of Colorado in Boulder, and then I raced professionally for 3 years. I was very lucky that the Women's Pro Tour was in its heyday just as I graduated from college, and I was able to step from school into pro ski racing with a resume and a portfolio and public speaking experience, and was really able to take pro ski racing to the next level from a professional standpoint. I retired from ski racing and went to work for Anheuser-Busch in broadcasting, special events, public relations, promotions, things like that. And this was probably, I think, 87. And so now I'm still traveling on the Pro Tour, working for Anheuser-Busch in broadcasting, but I'm not ski racing anymore. And I can specifically remember being in Squaw Valley for a race and riding up the chairlift and looking down going, oh, wow, I don't have to train anymore. It was like the first time in my life that I didn't have to run gates and practice. And all of a sudden, instead of looking down at the race course, I was looking up at the top of this fabulous mountain going, huh, I wonder how you get up there. I wonder what that's like. There was no extreme skiing. It didn't have a term. But being a good skier, I needed to challenge myself. And so I did it through finding the most difficult terrain I could possibly find and pushing my ability. And I can remember one time seeing a group of dudes that were all really good skiers. I was riding a lift and they were charging some big lines. And so I purposefully set myself up so that I was getting on the lift when they were getting on the lift so I could ski with them.
Wily move.
I ended up being the Delorier brothers and a gang that they were with. I met Greg Stump in 1989.
Did Bruce Benedict introduce you?
Pardon me?
Did Bruce Benedict introduce you?
Yes. So I worked with Bruce Benedict. He was a photographer and I did a bunch of modeling. He helped me put together my portfolio to get ready for racing professionally. I knew him in Boulder and he was working for Stumpy and Bruce introduced me to Greg. We shot License to Thrill in 1989. And it was because of that movie that I got invited to Alaska to compete in the first Worlds in 1991. And that was really the very first extreme skiing contest of all time.
How long did you compete in so-called extreme events and whom did you compete against? Who were your rivals?
In 1991, the first year was more like a festival. I think I was competing against the guys because there were very few women there. And it really didn't matter to me. I'd never been in a helicopter. I'd never worn a beacon. Doug Coombs was there and Dean Conway and Dean Cummings and a lot of great big mountain skiers that had a ton of experience. And I was just terrified and in awe at the same time. So winning in 1991 was not that difficult. I was just the best female skier there. I didn't even think I was going to get a trophy. So I was quite happy to have a little morsel of recognition. But I did go back to Crested Butte after that event and went to the marketing department, Gina Croft, and said, I just went to the coolest event I've ever been to in my life. And we need to jump on this and be a part of where this is going because it matches Crested Butte. And so that was kind of how Crested Butte got so involved. And the first year in Alaska, we had the National Ski Patrol as our safety crew. And they were more afraid than we were. I could go on and on and tell you some crazy stories of things that happened back in the beginning. Crested Butte not only got involved in hosting contests, they supplied the ski patrol for Alaska for the next 4 or 5 years as the high angle safety team. And it was a really fabulous relationship and made all of us that were up there competing feel much safer to have that crew up there back then.
You mentioned a 5-year window. How long did you compete in extreme events?
I had just started Women's Ski Adventures. So I started Women's Ski Adventures in 1989, the same year that I met Greg Stump. After winning in Alaska in 1991, my business was just taking off. And I decided that I really, in order to win again, I would have to really step up my game because not only did I go back and recruit Crested Butte, but I recruited every single good female skier I could find to go up and compete in that contest. I just realized that if I was going to win again, I really needed to be skiing very hard. And I wasn't doing it running Women's Ski Adventures. So I backed away and I went, continued to go up and I judged and I worked in broadcasting and I helped organize and continued to ski all of that amazing terrain in Alaska. And then I kind of went through a romantic setback in 1994 and decided that in order to heal and stifle my anger, I needed to compete again. I hired a young couple to help me run my business and I rolled up my sleeves and started working out and focused on the main contests at that time were Crested Butte, which was the U.S. Extremes. In the fall of 1994, there was the first ever South American Extremes, which were in Las Leñas, and then the Worlds that were in Alaska. And there was a couple other satellite events. I know Choco Moeller was running a few events at that same year, but those were the three big contests. And I was like, I want to go win those contests. I want to step back in the saddle and I want to compete again. And I'm going to give every ounce of energy that I have to competing and doing the best I can in those three contests. And so that was the 1994-95 season.
Have we reached a plateau in this big mountain arena in the sense that what the athletes are attempting and succeeding at are absolutely, seem to me, at the limit of what's possible? How much more risk is even possible? Where do you see it going from today's arena?
Jackson, that's That's a very difficult question to answer because I never would have thought that we would be where we are now. I mean, skiing is skiing and it hasn't changed. It's still two planks strapped to our feet and off we go. But in the beginning, most of us that were successful as big mountain skiers were ex-ski racers or mogul skiers, had quite a bit of training. Nowadays, these kids grew up on ski movies. They grew up from the time they strapped skis to their feet wanting to be a big mountain free skier. I mean, FIS just bought IFSA. I mean, it's become mainstream. And in doing so has opened the door to so many young athletes and even especially young women that the sky is the limit. And you can start going after and pursuing these kind of goals from the very first time you put your skis on. So the answer is, I don't think we've seen it the end. And I don't know what is next because I never would have imagined that things like skier cross and pipe and park and big air freestyle would be in the Olympics.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't realize until Stumpy told me on Tuesday that you were on the David Letterman show. First question is, was License to Thrill, which was Stumpy's first movie after the legendary Blizzard of Oz, was it your first ski movie? And I gather you never did another movie with Stump, but did you ski for the camera with anyone else during that period?
I had moments in Warren Miller films, nothing spectacular, just some girl skiing in a fancy outfit and a faceless, nameless skier that he made fun of. So I don't really count that. Yes, License to Thrill was my first movie. And honestly, Jackson, I didn't really like filming. I didn't like the time spent standing around, the logistics, the money. You know, it was a blast working with Greg Stump. And if it could have continued to be like that, where we were just a pack hanging out and having fun and shooting us skiing, it was great back then. And I loved it. And I loved the friends that I made, Mike Hattrip and Plake and Schmidt are all like really good friends of mine still. And I was honored to be with those guys and hang out with them. And I absolutely adored Greg Stump. He's funny and charismatic and passionate and so full of energy that I just feel extremely fortunate that I was with them during that time period. The next film that I skied was with Matchstick Productions, Steve Winter. And that also was an honor because those guys all came from Crested Butte. And I really respected them a lot. And they had been making movies for a pretty long time. And that they asked me to be a part of their movie was an honor. But I think it was after that film that I decided not to film anymore because it was just day after day after day of just hanging out and waiting for the weather. And then finally, the blue sky pops and the avalanche danger is high and you're scared to death. And you're supposed to ski better than you've ever skied in your life without a warm-up run. And it just wasn't my cup of tea. And at that time, my women's ski adventure program was crushing it. I had started another program, which went through a number of names. It was originally Extreme Adventures. And Scott Schmidt and I worked together for a couple of years. And I worked with Seth Morrison in Extreme Adventures as well. And then I decided extreme was too big of a word. So I switched to Black Diamond Adventures. So this was a co-ed program similar to Women's Ski Adventures. And now it's called Steep Skiing Camps. I really love my business. I love what I do. I love skiing with recreational skiers and helping them not only take their skiing to the next level, but to guide them in a much bigger way, help them see the big picture, teach them how to read terrain. Teach them how to read snow, how to make the most of their ski experience, way, way beyond just turning left and turning right. With the women, it's really rewarding because there's so much more to it. My female clients walk away feeling better about themselves. They're empowered by the experience. They took on risk and they overcame their fear and they walk away invigorated about themselves and their lives. And so I really preferred what I was doing in my business than skiing in movies. So I just really decided not to do any more filming.
What is it about skiing that connects with the human soul so that in the process of learning skiing, you learn who you are? It seems to me that skiing is much more of a mystical exercise if you open your heart and mind to it. I mean, maybe women are maybe even more receptive to this approach than men are. We'll talk about the advantages of women learning from women in a moment. You must have thought of this quite a bit since you've been in instruction for so long. How is it that skiing opens so much up for people once they grok the skiing part, they start to grok so much else? Am I making any sense to you? And
yes, I mean, you are. And it's not a short answer, Jackson. There's just so much going on in the sport. I mean, first of all, skiing's one of the only sports where if you do nothing, you're going to be out of control. I mean, you got to ride the bicycle. You got to run up the hill. All these other sports, you got to hit the ball. Someone's got to hit it back. You got to keep score. All these things that exist in other sports, skiing is unique in that if you do nothing, you're going to be out of control. So that's right from the start. It's about controlling gravity, which makes it very unique. So then learning the technique to control gravity and the fact that your confidence is based on this ability to control it. As you get better and better at it, your confidence increases more and more. And that level of confidence, that feeling that you have inside your heart and your soul when you sort of conquered the mountain or conquered that particular slope, and you feel a sense of reward and gratification that's much greater than a lot of other sports you do. And I think partially because it's just so risky. It's dangerous. You're overcoming your fears. You're teaching yourself the steps to have control. And with that control comes the enjoyment. I know with women's ski adventures, a lot of women don't get outside of their comfort zone very often.
Was it hard to convince women to ski this terrain that you had learned to treat as your backyard?
Absolutely. And there's so much more to building their confidence to do so. You know, men are entirely different. You know, the testosterone versus estrogen thing, I see it every single day in skiing, where women have fear. You know, I ask a woman what she wants and she'll say, well, I want to be in control. I want to look good. And I want to have fun. You ask a guy what he wants and he goes, well, I want to go fast. I want to ski the steepest slope. And I don't care what I look like doing it. And men just, you know, you think about little boys when they're young, you know, they break their arm riding their bicycle and they hold their cast up like a badge of honor. Look, I broke my arm. Like it's the coolest thing in the world. Well, you know, little girls don't break their arms unless their brother broke it. You know, and not, I mean, like on a pylon or a trampoline accident or something like that. But we as women, we are the nurturers. We are there to take care of ourselves, to reproduce, to look after the people that we love. It's in our nature. It's our chemical makeup. So it's much more difficult for women to just let go. And I can remember being back in the day before I started my business, seeing some dude at the top of Kirkwood Wall screaming at his girlfriend, what are you afraid of? Just go for it. And she's like taking her engagement ring off and throwing it down the slope screaming, I hate you. And it was experiences like that that made me want to start women's ski adventures, because I knew that skiing is this amazing sport with so much beauty and fluidity and invigoration that I wanted women to have that experience, but they weren't able to get there because nobody was teaching them in a way that would help them get through the fear.
Do you think women are more receptive to women than they are to men when it comes to communicating about how to manage fear?
I don't think it's a man versus women thing. It's how you communicate. And I think that it's easier for women to communicate with women when it comes to some of these emotions, because we're more understanding. We've been there. We can relate. I understand why you're afraid. Where with men, they don't really understand why we're afraid because they haven't had this. They don't chemically aren't made up like we are. They're like, what are you afraid of? Like, I don't get it.
Did your women's instruction program spawn an entire genre? There was a couple of gals who preceded you in having women-to-women camps, but aren't there many, many more iterations now?
I was the only game in town, really. I wasn't the first woman to think of doing women's-only ski instruction, but I was the first person that was independent of a ski school. And I was the first person that was actually a professional skier and was bringing in the background of ski racing and big mountain free skiing and college ski racing and all those experiences into a program that was, in my mind, more comprehensive than just a lesson for women.
As far as other athletic endeavors go, you were an expert, still are an expert windsurfer, a sport that enjoyed torturing me during my mercifully brief exposure. As I told you a few minutes ago, I spent most of my windsurfing time in Nerd Cove. But tell me, at the other end of the skill spectrum, the thrill of being in Hood River or Maui on a windsurfer compared to the thrill of being on the top of a big mountain on skis.
Very similar. And when I was talking earlier about that, I thought how skiing is a very unique sport because the experience and windsurfing, and now I'm a kiter, so I'm a kite surfer, and I'm now winging and wing foiling. These wind sports are similar to skiing in that there's nobody keeping track, there's nobody keeping score. You go out for hours on end and ride waves and wind swell, and you go across the bay or across the ocean. I live down in Mexico now on the Sea of Cortez, and I cherish my windy days and my time on the water and surfing. I surf as well, and I love surfing. I love the challenge of surfing because I'm not good at it. But I do find that there's a lot of similarities between wind sports and skiing.
Let's go back to something I only alluded to a little while ago, which is our shared experience on the Snow Country Magazine ski test. What do you recall most about our little event at Alpine Meadows? And dear listeners, just to put this in a little context, when Jackson Hogan runs a ski test, we don't run it for 3 or 4 days. We run it for 3 or 4 weeks. What do you recall about our adventures together at Alpine Meadows?
First, I was flattered that you asked me to be a part of that and feel extremely fortunate that I was, because I met so many fabulous people, including, you know, becoming friends with you. Now, 30 plus years later, 35 years later, or whatever, we're still friends. So thank you. And you know what? You were the only game in town. Now every magazine has their test. And even though Snow Country was a magazine, I didn't feel that at that time there was any pressure from the manufacturers. It was a very organic ski test. And it wasn't driven by who was buying advertising. It was just really a massive test where we were just open to say what we wanted and put the skis to the test. And we worked very, very hard for you, Jackson. I loved it, but it wasn't an easy job. You really had to concentrate, focus, and think about the differences in the skis, and not only know in your mind how they differed, but then how to articulate it in a way that could be published by you and understood by the public. For that, I love that the skills that it taught me to be intuitive to the differences in the skis and how to express it. And then just the people, the gang that we had, and the laughter and the fun, and just being in Tahoe in the springtime. I can remember I'd always
a certain amount of partying going on.
I wasn't going to say that, but you know.
Well, when we work hard, play hard, you know.
We did both.
Everyone had to get a little reward, a little more yummy treat than the $100 you got for a day. And that was really the opportunity to have this sort of community experience. Everyone really did care for each other. It was remarkable in that respect. The athletic talent assembled, well, that was what I was told to do. So I went and did it. I got the very best talent that we could get.
Well, and it was a coveted position. If you were invited to be a part of the Snow Country Ski Test, you were a lot of people that came to me over the years asking me how I could get them on your test. I always was like, yeah, you're going to have to do that yourself.
That was a wonderful time. I remember at the Vegas show, and I know you and I both believe that the Las Vegas venue was the ski show. That was when it really sizzled and popped and was a show. And it has certainly ceased to exist at all now. It's certainly not a show anymore. I can remember I did a stand-up routine after the Vegas show one day, and I got a bunch of other people across the street, including Stumpy and a few others. And it was at a little casino. By way of introduction to our audience, I had you on one arm and Christy Brown in the other. And both of you were looking at me like, what do you want us to do? And I said, just escort the pontiff to the stage. I'm in a white linen suit with a giant red mitre. And I went up and delivered one of my Pontiff of Powder spiels. And the evening went on from there. I think that might have been the night I left my luggage at the bar at one of the various casinos because I was partying so vigorously with the Canadians.
But was it before or after the food fight that we had in that restaurant. What restaurant were we in when we were in
Vegas? It was the Mexican restaurant at the bottom of the Hilton.
Okay.
There were a bunch of different restaurants in the bottom of the Hilton, and that was the Mexican one. It was the one where the wall looked best with guacamole on it.
The K2 table against the Powder magazine table?
Absolutely. It was the War of Publication. Whoever was in the middle definitely suffered because they were in a fearsome crossfire. Part of that energy was captured by the brand that you represented then and now, K2, but it was a different era and it was a different K2 then than it is now. And I want to take a moment to acknowledge the personal commitment of Tim Petrick and Jeff Matura, who together helped K2 weather the storm, I think, three times. They had to come back and rescue K2 from its own worst instincts. Whether it was Jeff or Tim, who you might thought of being the center of that energy field, if you will, between them, I don't think anyone put the show in Las Vegas show better than they did.
I have to agree. I mean, partially, I guess, because I was on that K2 team. And at the time, I almost felt like the world revolved around us. I mean, we were on fire. K2 was one of the first companies to do signature skis, you know, Seth Morrison, the Seth Pistol, and, you know, one of the very, very first ski companies that recognized athletes and was putting their names on those skis. I think Seth Morrison was the very first person, Petrick did. And the whole women's movement, the alliance thing, we were way ahead of the curve, so to speak, with doing women's specific skis and having a really legitimate women's design team that was making all the decisions. But not only were they on the cutting edge of design and being innovative, but they were very supportive of the team, the athletes. We spent a lot of time together. We went on trips together. We had parties and dinners and think tanks and hours where the wine and the beer was being passed around the group. And we were just talking about ideas. And there was no limitation. Both Jeff Matura and Tim Petrick allowed us as athletes to contribute. And they encouraged us to be creative. And some ideas were great and some weren't great. But the fact that kind of communication existed was really unique. And I feel that because K2 is an American company, we were a little bit more edgy, a little bit more open. We didn't come from this strict racing background. And Europeans can be so serious, especially when it comes to skiing and ski racing. And K2 was just having a good time. You look back at some of the old Wayne Wong posters and photos. He was a K2 athlete. They just really supported the funky and the fun. And they continued to do that for many, many years. And that's what made it so special to be a part of that program.
K2, in fact, dropped racing entirely at a time when it was regarded as essential for brand promotion. And they walked away with the enormous expense of that behind them and put some of the savings back into the free ride world. But there was a remarkable break, which has turned out to be, I think, phenomenally successful because absolutely nobody cares that K2 hasn't produced a race ski in years. This is not a factor in their business model today. I once saw you in person in Krusty Butt, as our familiar name for Crested Butte, when I was doing some training videos for Head at Matchstick Productions. How long did you live in Crested Butte and where did you move to and where are you now?
I'm a bit of a nomad, Jackson. I have a tendency to, if it's not a man that chases me out of town, it's the weather. And I love good weather and living places where the weather's great. And when a relationship ends, I pack my bags and move on and start over. I moved to Crested Butte full time in 92. And I stayed for about 15 years. I loved Crested Butte. And actually, I tried to have children. And if I had had children, I probably would have stayed. Because Crested Butte is an amazing community and would have been a fabulous place to raise children. And one of the reasons why I left Crested Butte was because it was very painful for me to be surrounded by all of my friends who were raising children. And I was not in that program. And I kind of needed to move on and get a fresh start. So I moved to Aspen. And that was in 2005.
That seems like jumping from one fire into an inferno. I mean, Aspen is high-level fun-seeking. Crested Butte is funky as a fun-seeking, but Aspen is billionaire fun-seeking. And billionaires, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid, yes, they do have more fun than some people anyway.
Aspen was always on my radar, Jackson. From the time I went there when I was a young ski racer, I saw Cheech and Chong on stage when I was 16 years old in Aspen. I was like, this is a grown-up town. There's a lot of trouble in this place. And I really like Aspen a lot, but I sort of forced myself to not move there until I got a little bit more mature and could make better decisions. And
yeah. It's not a junior varsity town.
No, it is not. But you know what, Jackson, I love about Aspen the most? Their upper management is phenomenal. They just do such a great job of running that mountain. Everybody that I know that works for Aspen Ski Company loves their job, respects their manager, goes to work with a smile on their face. Their customer service is phenomenal. And the general feeling in the town is one of respect, and the resort and the town and the ski area managements all work together very well. And it's just it's a really, really positive environment. So you have a lot of this money, but you have a very philanthropic community, a lot of people that give back, environmentally very conscientious. There's just a lot of positivity throughout the town of Aspen, on the mountain and off.
I think it's a very, very special place. And I've always sort of disregarded the moneyed crowd, not that they don't contribute in some important ways in terms of, you know, funding a lot of great things that the Aspen community does. But that's not where the energy seems to be coming from. If you go to Aspen as a skier, you will discover that no one is on the mountain but you when the gondola starts spinning out of town. It may be on some weekend you may find yourself with a line, but Aspen is a sleep-in town. A lot of people are recovering well into the late morning in Aspen, and you can get up and run nonstops down Copper Bowl and Spar Gulch. And you don't have to worry about dodging the multitudes because the multitudes are still in their five-star hotel.
Well, the other thing, Jackson, about Aspen, which is very unique to other resorts, is we have four mountains. So we have Snowmass, Buttermilk, Highlands, and Aspen Mountain, which is called Ajax, or used to be called Ajax. So from the beginning of the day, everybody spreads out. The kids and the beginners and the Pipe and Park kids go to Buttermilk, and the snowboarders and the beginners and the young families go to Snowmass, and the hardcore locals that want to hike the bowl or the bumpers go to Highlands. So, you know, versus a lot of other resorts where you have one or maybe two lifts from the base and everybody has to get on one of those two lifts and then spread out. In Aspen, everybody spreads out from the base. So your only days that you really have any kind of lines or crowds in the morning is on a powder day when it might be a little bit slow to get the mountain open. Maybe Highlands isn't open yet because they've gotten even more snow. So that's one of the things that makes Aspen seem so uncrowded. I mean, yes, there are people that don't come out till 10 and ski till 2 and spend the rest of the afternoon in the private club up on the mountain. But the truth is that there's a lot of people skiing. They're just spread out way more than most resorts.
What's a typical ski day look like for you? And let's divide it into two. A typical ski day when, yay, you can go ski anywhere you want, do whatever you want. And a work day. And please tell us when you're doing your next workday session.
With women ski adventures, I have some women that come to ski with me who really want to get better. They're just like, I'm getting married. My husband's a really good skier and you got to get me better fast. And then I have empty nesters who just want to ski and have fun and enjoy company and be around great other women and be safe. And then some of my older clients who have been skiing with me for years and years and years, they're like, I don't need to get better. I just enjoy the mountains. My husband doesn't want to ski anymore. And if I come with you, I know I'll be well taken care of and have fun people to hang out with. So my women's ski adventure program has a lot of different groups of abilities and mindset. And I take 12 in a group. I have a staff of 3 plus me. So I'm totally overstaffed and I'm able to take care of everybody. So whatever it is they want, I focus on equipment. I want to make sure that everybody's in the right gear because that's very important. And all of my women's ski adventures, we start in the ski shop and we go out on the hill and we come back to the ski shop. So we can fine tune your boots while you have a glass of wine in your hand, because that's equally as important.
And where are we doing this now? Where is your next camp
going to be? Women's ski adventures this year, I have three. I have one in Aspen, one in Snowmass, and one in Alta. And then I have a co-ed steep skiing camp in Alta as well. And then I have 3 weeks in Japan, which is just guided skiing. Then I'm doing a five-day trip to Silverton. And I'm doing a heli-ski trip to Alaska and a heli-ski trip in Greenland. So there's different levels of what I'm doing. So there's the clinics. And then there's the adventure skiing. And my goal is for everybody to go adventure skiing. You know, when someone comes and skis with me, I want to be like, let's get you into some powder. What are we going to have to do to get you there? Because powder is the most fun of all. Sometimes we have to go chase it down.
So that raises the inevitable question, when and where can we ski together again? That sounds like you and I might cross paths in Alta.
That would be great. I'm in Alta starting March 8th.
We should stay in touch because March and Alta and I kind of mix well. Snowbird is actually my host because Dave Fields is absolutely wonderful in taking care of my every need at Snowbird. And a lot of times we try to call Alta, no one answers the phone.
Yeah. It's a little more. That's what I love about Alta.
So let's plan on that. Let's try to get together.
That would be really a couple of days. I have 2 4-day camps. And then on the fifth day of each camp is an optional heli ski day with Powder Bird. So put that on your radar. So for my clients, you know, if they want to take their skiing to the next level, but they're not sure they're good enough yet, they come to me, they take the clinic. And if they're really ready and I'm comfortable with that, then we go for an additional heli ski day if they want to do that. So I might have an empty seat or something available for you at Powder Bird.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've skied Powder Bird many times and it is fabulous.
Powder Bird is who I'm going to Greenland with. He went to Powder Bird in Greenland in the past. And this year we have a yacht, Ship Tulu, when we're staying on the boat and flying off the boat every day. And the great part, because I've been to Greenland before and it's pretty difficult from a staging standpoint. So the yacht allows us to move deeper into the fjords and around the island or continent or country or all the above to access terrain that you wouldn't normally be able to access because we'll be sleeping on the boat, the helicopter will be on the boat, and the fuel and all the food will be with us. So we're self-contained.
Wow. Again, where can my dear listeners get more information? Is womenskiadventures.com or is it just Ski with Kim?
Skiwithkim.com.
Skiwithkim.com. Please check it out, ladies and gentlemen. You are absolutely going to fall in love. My guest today, Kim Reichel. Thanks for playing with me today.
Thank you, Jackson. It's lovely to catch up.
Yeah, it's been great. And thank you, dear listeners, for your kind attention. I'll talk to you again next week.